Hey, what a theme today. Junk, bums, and now trash. When Professor Jeff Farrell quit his job as a tenured professor and moved back to his hometown of Fort Worth, Texas, he began an eight-month odyssey of living pretty much off of the street. Empire of Scrounge tells the story of this unusual journey while delving into the politics of street life. In this book, he goes inside the urban underground of dumpster diving, trash picking, and street scavenging, say that three times fast, and comes up with a really amazing and unique look at the boundaries of legality and counterculture. Here to talk about his new book, Empire of Scrounge, is Professor Jeff Farrell. He is a professor in the Department of Sociology, Criminal Justice, and Anthropology at Texas Christian University, and he's the author of so many amazing books. It's just hard to list them all, but most recently, Tearing Down the Streets, Adventures in Urban Anarchy, a book I wish I had written, along with the landmark Cultural Criminology, Crimes of Style, and so many others. So here on Justice or Just Us is Professor Jeff Farrell. Jeff, how are you today?
Good. Thanks very much for having me on, Jarrett.
This is, we've spoken so many times through email, so it's great to be able to speak to you one-on-one. Thank you for joining us this morning. I got to ask you, how did all of this begin? What brought about a desire to, I don't know if you want to talk about leaving your job, but what brought about the impetus for this experiment or project? How do you even refer to it?
Well, I would say it was existential and political, which is always a dangerous combination. Listening to Utah Phillips sing the old great wobbly hymn, Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, or On the Bum, reminded me of some of my motivations. As you suggested earlier, I sort of had it with my job. I was a tenured professor, but was not enjoying it. And so decided just to quit and, again, embrace being a bum. I sort of knew that tradition and felt like in some ways, work is the blackmail of existence, as the situationist always said. And so I decided to get out from under that blackmail and embrace being a bum for a while. So on one hand, it was very much a kind of sense of reclaiming myself and trying to see if I could, in fact, survive on my own terms outside of the bureaucracy and the weekly paycheck of academia. There are a couple other things as well. One is that I've spent much, as you suggested with some of those book titles, I've spent much of my adult life in one marginal situation or another by choice and out of research with hip-hop graffiti writers and urban social movements and groups like Reclaim the Streets and Food Not Bombs and Critical Mass. And so this was simply, I suppose, another case of looking for the margins and finding comfort there. But I guess the final thing was really, and we could talk more about this, wanting to look at consumer society and the consequences of consumerism from a different angle, really from the sort of inside the engorged dumpsters as opposed to from inside my office.
Yeah, now you're certainly one who has never been a traditional academic. I mean, Your book, Crimes of Style, looked at, as you mentioned, hip-hop graffiti. And your most recent book, Tearing Down the Streets, takes a look not at what people consider traditional crimes per se, but maybe behaviors that are kind of at the boundaries between legality and perhaps what we could call counterculture. In Tearing Down the Streets, you talk about so many different adventures you've had, whether it's I think it's called busking when you perform on the streets as a musician, and is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And a whole bunch of doing the base jumpings and so many different things. So, of all of the different kind of non-academic ways you could take a look at deviance, why did you choose dumpster diving? Was it to take a look at consumer culture? Was this the most obvious and expedient way to do that?
Yes, I would say, well, a couple of things. One is it gave me a chance to actually, in some ways, become the phenomenon. I think one of the dangers we face as researchers or writers or academics is, despite all of our good intentions, it's difficult, I think, sometimes to get close enough to the phenomenon to really have a sense of it, not just intellectually, but emotionally and experientially. So I decided to, again, to sort of to become a dumpster diver, to live that way, not having other income, not having a job or a book contract or, you know, a tenured position, allowed me certainly in no way would I want to suggest I suddenly became homeless or became an impoverished person. But as best I could, it did force me to make decisions on the streets and to live in that kind of way as well. So in that sense, it was part of who I was trying to become, and I guess in some ways being honest to what I wanted to find out. But as you say, also, absolutely, it was I thought that, you know, it was a rare chance, really, to see consumerism and to investigate its consequences from the angle of those who dig through the trash of consumerism, as opposed to simply, you know, accounting for how much we consume as Americans or that sort of thing.
Okay. And I'm sure listeners of this program know a lot of the statistics because we've focused on consumer culture before, but do you have any statistics about, you know, for example, the United States is, what, 5% of the world's population, but we consume, you know, X percent of the world's goods?
Yes. Well, I don't have the numbers on top of my head because, if you know me, numbers aren't my forte. I think, you know, sometimes numbers mask as much as they reveal. But I would, for example, cite the recent World Institute study that talked about, you know, the United States consuming ever more of the world's resources, and sadly, that pattern is being exported along with our military conquest and other patterns. I think we're clearly exporting that sort of hyper-consumerism, so that the World Institute and others are finding we now seeing those kinds of patterns of hyper-consumption emerging in you know, middle class worlds around the globe. And so, in that sense, you know, I guess beyond numbers, it strikes me that this is one of the most profound problems we face is the not only the consequences of global capitalism in terms of exploitation of child labor and destruction of local markets, but a voracious consumption of planetary resources.
Sure. And I think the number we have an Adbusters you know, kind of culture jamming cart that we play every once in a while, and I know it's kind of outdated, but I believe the numbers, which really aren't as important as just illustrating the disproportion, but the numbers are that we're about 5% of the world's population but consume 25% of the world's natural resources, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes,
yeah,
right.
We get the point. So I want to remind listeners that they're in tune to KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM. This is Justice or Just Us. We're speaking with Jeff Farrell. He is the author most recently of Empire of Scrounge, Inside the Urban Underground of Dumpster Diving, Trash Picking, and Street Scavenging. So how did you begin this odyssey, if you will? What was it like waking up one morning and knowing that you were about to begin an 8-month journey? Or I don't know if you knew how long it was going to last, but, you know, knowing that for the next foreseeable future, you were going to be involved in this kind of world.
Right. Well, first of all, you make a good point. It turned out to be 8 months because I wound up with an academic job after 8 months. But two things there. One is I certainly did not know that. In fact, to be very honest, at that point, I was quite happy to be outside the confines of everyday alienated labor. And so in that sense, I was facing, actually, to be honest, quite happily, an unknown future. And I've certainly continued to dumpster dive on a daily basis, even though I'm now back in academia. But secondly, I would say I found it profoundly liberating. It was a remarkable experience to sort of take charge of one's own life and to see if through ingenuity and pedaling my bicycle and getting to know other trash divers, if I could learn how to survive from this world. And in fact, I did. I found it actually relatively easy, with as long as there were some accommodations made to survive. But as you say, it required a openness to uncertainty and a willingness to sort of embrace the future as it unfolded, as opposed to the usual sense of, you know, of leases and apartment payments and paychecks and that sort of thing. So I suppose in one sense it was daunting, but I found it really more enjoyable than anything else, and tried to really commit myself to that. I did not present myself to folks as an academic or a writer, because at that point I wasn't. I was simply trying to live this way and learn from other people how to do so.
Is dumpster diving legal? I know that that's not a very straightforward there's not a straightforward answer. Your book talks about some of the legal ambiguities of dumpster diving. Could you just give some examples?
Sure, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that was certainly my other driving motivation. And in Tearing Down the Streets, the previous book, I discovered a remarkable sort of clampdown on everyday life, and certainly the everyday lives of marginal folks in urban environments, you know, through laws targeting the homeless and prohibiting sleeping in parks and this sort of thing, and laws that are obviously being used to drive homeless folks out of central city areas. So my sense was that this is what was going on as well with dumpster diving, and I'm afraid I found it even more starkly than I anticipated. Laws increasingly that outlaw the possession of a shopping cart away from the premises of a grocery store, which of course, takes away the primary means of accumulation for many homeless people. Laws in Houston and elsewhere that literally outlaw the lifting of a dumpster lid on the grounds that that creates a public nuisance. In Fort Worth and elsewhere, very aggressive code enforcement against anyone who accumulates materials or tries to resell them. And so you're right. As a criminologist, I really feared what I would find, and in fact I did find that we were seeing a sort of legal exhaustion of the margins, that for folks who were trying to carve out or were forced to carve out existence on their own, it was being made more and more difficult by an increasingly tight net of regulations and enforcement strategies.
I think it's so interesting. It's just another example of a society, a criminal justice system, a legal system that rather than trying to get at some of the root causes, if there are such things, simply tries to deal with symptoms. So rather than create a habit of consumption that doesn't produce so much waste that would lead to dumpster diving, and rather than try to create an economy that can provide for everyone, they simply, pass these regulations that you're not allowed to lift the lid of a dumpster diver or, walk around the town with a shopping cart. Or one of my favorites was the dumpster diver who was looking, of course, for cans and bottles and plastic recyclables, and was warned that if he picked up a beer can that had a little bit of alcohol remaining in it, he could be cited for being in public with an open container. Am I getting that right?
That's right. One fellow I met, a fascinating guy who actually was disabled in a wheelchair, as was his wife, and could not make it on his disability check. So had rigged his wheelchair to cruise the curbs of the neighborhoods and pick up cans. But again, was afraid that he might be arrested for moving about with an open container because, as you said, there might be a speck of beer left in a can. And I think further outrage comes from the fact that much of this is presented as an aesthetic issue or an issue of beautifying the city, that it's somehow unappealing to see someone pushing a cart or lifting a dumpster lid or with some accumulations of copper or brass on their back porch. And so, as you say, what a tragedy that not only do we not address the kind of world that creates, on the one hand, hyperconsumption and waste, and on the other hand, whole groups of folks forced to live from that, but that we being city governments and upper-class business interests, define that as really an issue of how the city should look and not wanting to displease our eyes by having to see folks scrounging for a living. As you say, just outrageous.
And, of course, the issue of food, not bombs, which we don't need to get into too extensively here, but listeners of this program are certainly familiar with Food Not Bombs. And interestingly, Orange County, California has several Food Not Bombs chapters. Who would think that in nice, conservative, and wealthy Orange County, there's so many chapters of Food Not Bombs. But of course, we know that not only here in Orange County, but throughout the country, and particularly San Francisco and Berkeley, police departments have cracked down on Food Not Bombs because they take otherwise discarded food and cook it up and give it to homeless or the hungry in the park. And of course it attracts, a food distribution line. And right. Who would think that that would be something criminal? It's usually the kinds of messages that we encourage individuals, at least in grade school, to go out and do. And then when they do it, of course they're criminalized. But,
absolutely. It is remarkable. We really do, without overstating it, see the criminalization of aid. I think it's just as you're suggesting, with Food Not Bombs, being denied permits to serve food and then busted for not having permits. Here in Fort Worth, one case I discovered and talked to folks about, a little community church that serves mostly the immigrant community, opened a sort of a charity shop and then was busted for not having a permit to run a shop. And so then had to, as you saw in the book, had to go through these contortions when someone would ask in their broken English, how much is this shirt? They'd say, well, there's no price, but we often get 25 cents. So as you say, somewhere between mean-spirited and a sort of pervasive clampdown on survival, I would argue. As I said in the book, you don't want to overstate it, but you're struck when you see the accumulation of these laws and strategies, but with the notion that really, it's the old consume quietly and die, that there's really not much space left out there except the private home and the mall in which to solve problems or to address the needs of other people. And I think that's one thing certainly I wanted to do with the book, was to show just how large that underground is. As you say, it is Orange County and Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston and New York. Those folks are everywhere, and they're doing great work, but increasingly they're doing it against the law or against the impetus of the law.
Well, one of your motivations was to take a look at consumer culture gone awry. So
yes.
Why don't you tell our listeners some of your favorite things that you found while dumpster diving?
Well, I often get asked that question, and it's difficult to answer only because the finds were so pervasive. If you can imagine it, I found it. I'm sitting here in my office at home, and just looking around, video cameras, still cameras, stereo systems, DVDs, framed photos, antique silverware, glass doorknobs, glass bricks, clothes, shoes. Most of the clothes I still wear, most of the shoes I wear are scrounged, and that after having given hundreds of sets of shoes and clothes, of course, to shelters and to those who needed them. So it's really remarkable. Someone was saying the book almost sometimes reads like a underground department store, because there's simply everything you would find at a mall is in a dumpster a month later. Some of them, remarkable finds. I mean, behind Victoria's Secret, 12 Victoria's Secret mannequins, or just recently, by the way, about a week ago, I found a Trek 300 Navigator bicycle, apparently bought brand new, never ridden, left out in the weather and then buried in a dumpster. So that's now my transportation. So everything from high-end bicycles to 100-year-old antiques, the dumpsters are full of them, and the trash bags are full of them.
It's funny that I liked that the Victoria's Secret scenario in the book. It kind of reminds me, I know that you talk a lot about in your book Evasion, which listeners of this program will probably know from the folks at Crime Think.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite episodes in Evasion, which is the story of an individual who spends, I think, a year, traveling the country, not contributing whatsoever to the economy, whether he's a freegan, as it's called, or
yes,
just having a good time. He goes to an arcade where they've got the skee ball, and you get the little tickets, and when you score points, and then you turn the tickets in for prizes, and of course you need thousands and thousands to get a prize worthy of all that time. And he would just dumpster dive in the back of video arcades and find all of those discarded tickets,
right,
and turn them in and get the prizes, and then trade them back at Walmart or the like.
Right.
And it's just amazing what people throw out, and how you could go ahead and give waste a second life, whether it's, again, legally or sometimes kind of on the borders. But tell our listeners about an individual you met named Dan Phillips, who really seemed to have quite a skill at giving discarded objects a second life.
Well, yes, I must say, if nothing else, the book was worth doing to meet Dan Phillips. Of all places, Dan Phillips lives and works in Huntsville, Texas, which your listeners may know as the notorious, Texas death machine, death house down there not far from his house. And so here Dan is in the belly of the beast. And yet what he's doing is his training, actually, I found out, was as a dancer and an academic. And some other background characteristics as well. But again, tired of that, and decided to build homes for the poor, but in a remarkable way, which is that Dan takes used building materials, excuse me, which he gets both from lumber yards and from people's donations, and again from scrounging the landfills, and builds remarkable houses that have recently been featured in Fine Architecture magazine. Hickory nut doorknobs and old shower stalls that are now skylights, and 2x4 cutoffs that are made into turreted stairwells. And even more amazing is that Dan hires folks without skills at minimum wage to build the houses, teaches them to be carpenters, and then sells them the houses, financing them himself if need be. So the person now not only has a home, but has a skill that they now can use to do some meaningful work. So it really is remarkable what Dan has accomplished. And I think that shows what we can do if, as you say, we're creative about and take a collective sensibility about taking these cast-offs and putting them back into not only into circulation, but really making them the foundation for people's lives and for a sense of hope and social change.
We're speaking with Jeff Farrell. He is the author of Empire of Scrounge, Inside the Urban Underground of Dumpster Diving. It is available at NYU Press. The book reads the book certainly doesn't read like the traditional academic book, which is certainly a good thing. At the same time, you can't help but find a lot more theory and metaphor than one would expect without it really hitting one over the head. How is dumpster diving and your examination of dumpster diving kind of a metaphor for contemporary culture?
Well,
and more importantly, contemporary political culture.
Right. Well, first of all, I appreciate that. I take that as a compliment that it doesn't read like an academic book, and that's certainly intentional. I think we really must quit just talking to each other. And, the irony that often academics and intellectuals take pride in how unreadable their work is, that's not only self-serving, it's also a great way to marginalize yourself from being a public intellectual. So that certainly was the intention, was to write a book that people might enjoy or actually find some pleasure in reading and not the usual sort of academic tome. As you say, that I think in no way does that mean that we don't do analysis or critique. And so as you suggested, for example, I began to record the origins of the objects I was finding, and I found, for example, after Christmas, people discarding Christmas treasures that had become part of their family's lives, and yet when you flip the treasure over, it was made in Malaysia or made in China. And so even on a kind of global scale, I suppose a permutation on think globally, act locally, I suppose it was a global critique that I was finding in people's trash, which was, here are the origins in a world economy of what they have now defined as their treasures or their traditions, and yet, of course, they're fraudulent in the sense that they were their children's treasures are made by other children who have no treasures. So on that level, it seemed to me it was a window into the circulation of goods in global capitalism. But even more so, I found it to be a remarkable way to simply document the pervasiveness of waste, not as an abstraction, but in it, literally on what I was hauling home on my bicycle. And as I talk about in the book, clothes with the tags still on them, bought apparently, I suppose, in a flurry of consumption, never worn, gifts left over from a baby shower that had never been opened. And so clearly, going all the way back to Thorsten Veblen, here was conspicuous consumption. Consumption is a kind of ritual or a ceremony, but with no need attached to it whatsoever. So it did seem to me a beautiful way to, and I use the word existential, I guess, a really sort of experiential way for me to experience and try to document the consequences of our society, not as an abstraction, but day-to-day down in the trash bags.
Yeah, and I think some of those examples about, thinking globally by acting locally, we have to remember that every time we throw something away, particularly something that was manufactured overseas, we're really setting in motion a whole chain of events where there's going to be international trade, which means that there's going to be, diesel fuel required to ship the stuff overseas. There's going to be probably child labor taking place somewhere else. There's going to be, outsourcing and downsizing and things taking up a landfill and global warming and so on and so forth. And these are things that, we don't want to burden people every time they throw something away. But it's really something to be considered that, can this go to a Salvation Army or a Goodwill? Can this this piece of clothing go to a thrift store where someone, some young street kid would probably love to,
that's right.
Come on. And I think it really is important to think of trash every time one throws something away as a metaphor for something bigger, as well as just the short attention span that we seem to have, where one day something is just our prized possession, and the next day it's tossed aside like yesterday's news.
Great point. I think that's an excellent point. And again, that short attention span is not just a failure of our own intellects, but certainly programmed into us and taught to us through advertising that, the turnover of fashion and design and next year's, faster computer is a selling of panic in some ways, that we're meant to be in a perpetual panic to consume the next wave of items. Well, as you say, we can certainly critique that on the level of consumption, but we also have to look at how the discards then become part of that process as well. And I would say, too, again, not burdening ourselves, but simply being aware that I think many of us, I'm sure many of your listeners take pride, I certainly do, and making sure all my recyclables are sorted and that my orange rinds go to my compost heap, and perhaps on our college campuses that we have recycling bins, and that's wonderful. But one thing I found is that for every one act like that, there are 1,000 acts committed by those who are increasingly defined as criminal, which really save tons of materials from the landfill, and as you say, in that sense, back to the Wobblies, sort of throw a wrench in the machinery of global capitalism, because there are, in any major city, thousands of folks out there keeping stuff from the landfill and hauling scrap metal into the scrapyard, and as you say, giving new life to clothes and food. And so, as you say, to be aware of that and to realize that those are acts, those are progressive acts that we need to honor and perhaps learn how to engage in more, and certainly not ignore as some kind of problem.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to open the discussion up a little bit to a broader topic, which seems to be a running theme in your work. You, I don't know if you personally coined the term cultural criminology, but it's been a theme in your body of work over many years. And it's something that I think really is driven home by the book Empire of Scrounge. Could you define cultural criminology and link it back to your book Empire of Scrounge?
Sure, be glad to. I did actually coin that term. You realize you're getting old. It's been a decade ago in a book back in 95. And my notion was, I guess, really two dynamics that intersect, I think, politically. One was that it seems to me it's impossible to talk about crime or justice or transgression or law and order at this point in our society without seeing those as cultural constructions. That is, that they are manufactured for us by primetime programming, excuse me, and politicians and media people, et cetera. So it seemed to me that most of our sensibility about crime and justice, most of our fears about certain kinds of crimes or our lack of awareness about others is not through direct experience, but through a mediated symbolic environment that is carefully orchestrated for us through sound bites and official statistics and this sort of thing. And so it struck me as someone who was trying to be critical politically and do progressive work that along with, you know, confronting the death penalty or racism in the criminal justice system, we had to confront the media construction of crime and the way in which that's sold to us. But that also suggested to me that another level on which we've got to look at culture is that those who are defined as criminal, those groups who are marginalized and often criminalized unjustly, have their own way of life and have their own symbolic environment, their own meanings, whether those are, again, hip-hop graffiti writers or low-rider cruisers or homeless folks scrounging for aluminum cans. And that part of our duty, I think, as critical intellectuals is to acknowledge and begin to try to understand the dynamics of their lives and the way those symbols and meanings and emotions emerge in situations. So it seemed to me on every level that an important political lever in trying to work toward a more just society was to think of criminology, if by that we mean sort of the critical study of crime and justice, as a cultural enterprise, as something that had to be done in the realm of representation and symbolism and meaning and not just through official stats or, you know, objective research, that sort of thing.
And, you know, I got to tell you that you certainly helped me get through graduate school because it was 95, I think, was when I started grad school, and I came across this book, Cultural Criminology, and opened up the intro and saw your discussion of the criminalization or attempted criminalization, if you will, of the art of Robert Mapplethorpe.
Yes.
And truth be told, that is precisely why I decided to go to graduate school. I've always been fascinated with the criminalization of speech.
Yes.
And whether it's flag burning, whether it is obscenity or pornography, or the idea that music lyrics could somehow lead to bigger and, you know, you listen to a record and then you go out and you commit suicide or try to kill a cop or whatever. And I really had no idea as a, you know, a bright-eyed grad student in a, you know, a quantitative program, how I could go ahead and pursue this line of inquiry by looking at kind of how culture itself is subject for criminalization. And I came across your book and have moved forward from there, always using your work as CC, it can be done. And it is relevant. So with that, I certainly want to thank you for coining that term and for staying in academia, at least until I get tenure. So
I'll do my best.
The book is titled Empire of Scrounge, Inside the Urban Underground of Dumpster Diving, Trash Picking, and Street Scavenging. It's available at NYU Press. I would also direct listeners to Tearing Down the Streets, Adventures in Urban Anarchy, which I believe is on Palgrave. Is that how you pronounce
That's
it?
That's right, yeah. St. Martin's Palgrave, right. Yeah.
And then if you want to get maybe a little bit more academic, check out Cultural Criminology, which is available at Northeastern University Press.
That's right.
Or you could just do a Google of Jeff Farrell. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and you definitely have to come back.
Oh, I'd love to, Jared. Thanks. It's a real pleasure talking with you, and be happy to rejoin you anytime.
Take care.
Thanks very much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.